This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Abraham Verghese, treated people with AIDS in a small town that was slow to admit it was part of the AIDS epidemic. From 1985 to 1990, he was a staff physician at a hospital in Johnson City, Tennessee. Dr. Verghese didn't initially set out to treat people with AIDS, but his specialty was infectious diseases, and his medical studies coincided with the rise of the epidemic. He's written a memoir about his AIDS work in Tennessee called My Own Country. America is actually Dr. Verghese's adopted country. He grew up in Ethiopia, where his parents had moved from India. Dr. Verghese first came to America in 1973 to study medicine. He continued his studies in India, then returned to America in 1980. He says that in the absence of a cure for AIDS, his job was to minister to the patient's soul and psyche, to pay attention to his family and his social situation, to make more house visits. But all of this came at a price.
Well, I think conventional medicine doesn't really gear itself to providing that kind of care. And one of the first things that you realize when you enter the field of taking care of people with HIV infection is that when you have nothing to offer in terms of a cure, you still have a lot to give, and perhaps what you have to give is very akin to what physicians at the turn of the century gave. That is to say, your presence, your concern, your willingness to be there with them through some of their suffering. And when I began to realize that this was the commodity I had to offer, it was disappointing to see that there really wasn't room in the grand scheme of medical care for me to do that and still, you know, use my time efficiently and even get reimbursed for that kind of time. But I think AIDS brings about a great distinction between healing and curing. One of the interesting things to me is that all of us who work in HIV care have come to recognize this distinction. And physicians are fortunate enough to be in specialties where you can just administer a cure almost seem to have had that part of themselves atrophy. They're not really all that comfortable or aware of the impact that they have on their patients or can have in this fashion.
Let me ask you to elaborate on the distinction you're making between healing and curing.
Well, I think that, you know, at the turn of the century, when a physician who I admire, like Osler, who's a very important academic physician, and many of the things we do in academic circles reflects Osler's teaching. But when he saw a case of pneumonia, he would go over the patient carefully, percuss the lung, auscultate the lung, and then provide his treatment, which in those days were various forms of inhalation and poultices and so on. And at the very same time, an American Indian physician, say, would also sort of diagnose the disease his own way and have his own treatment, which might consist of certain medicines and rituals and so on. When penicillin came along, the Western physician, I feel, pretty much just stepped back from the bedside and said, well, here's the penicillin. I don't really need to sit with you and minister to you. Whereas the American Indian shaman recognized the importance of penicillin, but also recognized the importance of continuing to provide the sort of healing function. And I sense that some of the resentment that the public has for physicians as a whole comes because we stepped away from that sort of healing function with our obsession with cure. And the more technologically sophisticated we've become, the less comfortable we seem to be with the idea of, you know, our presence and our care and our concern being of itself, a healing. And all of us who have entered AIDS care have come to realize that since this is all we have to offer, it's something that we need to pay attention to, and we've come to realize that it's not trivial at all. In fact, it's a wonderful thing to be able to bring about that kind of a healing, even when the disease that you're dealing with ultimately winds up taking their life.
How did you decide how much of your time, and therefore of your family's time, was the appropriate amount of time to give, and where it was perhaps appropriate to draw the line and say, I have to save this time for myself or my wife or my children?
I found that extremely difficult to do. I found myself really being pulled across this threshold where there's a sort of threshold that we all seem to stop at instinctively as physicians. But there's something about HIV care, at least in my setting, which was that I was looking at young men who were the same sex as I was, the same age as I was for the most part, had the same aspirations, and I could identify with them. And it was almost like looking at a reflection of myself. And I found that I could really not begrudge them my time when it seemed to be all I had to offer. And as time went on, AIDS became like this secret mistress that kept drawing me away from my family, that kept being something that pulled me away from other responsibilities, and at the same time, not something I could talk about freely, because I couldn't really expect anyone else to empathize with that experience. And the question they would immediately ask me is, well, you know, why do you, if it's, you know, so disturbing to you, why do you give so much of your time from it? Why don't you just pull back?
And that would have been hard to do.
That would have been, at the time, I couldn't conceive of it.
How did your wife feel when you were in Johnson City about all the time that you were spending with people with AIDS? Was she more worried than you were about contracting the virus and perhaps spreading it to the family?
I think that initially we had concerns primarily because there were several times when I had needle sticks, and I think all of us who work in this field from time to time do that, and we went the condom and the abstinence route, and you know, to even bring this up with your spouse, even though you know that it's a very low-risk thing to be stuck by a needle, there are not that many instances of the virus being transmitted in that fashion. Nonetheless, to bring this up is to bring something home from work and lay it on the dining table, so to speak, and it lingers there as a presence long after the danger, so to speak, is over. I think that she worried about what was happening to me, that I clearly was becoming a different kind of physician than my peers in this small town, that as time went on, I began to feel, and I think this was true, that I had become tainted by the association. And the association of AIDS in a small town is not just plague. It's more than that. It also speaks to a certain kind of sexuality. It's not even a sexually transmitted disease. It's a disease that points at homosexuality in a very peculiar way that perhaps is less so in New York City or Philadelphia or places like that. But in that town, the association was such that even blood transfusion recipients and hemophiliacs, when you pin them down as to what it was that they were hiding from, it was the association not with plague but with homosexuality, when in their case it didn't really apply. And in some ways I was becoming tainted by this, and being the AIDS doctor in a town is a dubious distinction in a small town in Tennessee. And I think she worried about this, and she was concerned that it was affecting the way we were perceived in this town and affecting the way some of her interactions went. I can remember her telling me that the wife of a physician I would call on from time to time to do a bronchoscopy, the wife told my wife that every time I called with a consult, he experienced a great deal of trepidation because he didn't know if I was calling for him to do a procedure on one of my AIDS patients. So as you can see, there were many ramifications outside of the medical sphere into our personal and social lives.
I guess confidentiality became very important to your patients. In Tennessee, were there extremes that you were expected to go to maintain the confidence about their illness?
It was the single most important issue about AIDS in a small town was secrecy. And I had people, actually who I describe in the book, who came to me from almost 100 miles away, had me go through the subterfuge of having them register under a different name and have me talk to their sons and basically tell the sons that he had a form of lymphoma, all because they couldn't imagine anyone in their town learning that they had AIDS. Now, they acquired AIDS by blood transfusion, in their own words, quotes, innocently, so to speak. But as the man told me, he said, if I was to ever step into my church, having let the word out that I had AIDS, when I went for service, I would be the only one there. I think he was wrong, but the interesting thing is that that was the belief that prevailed.
Most of the AIDS patients who you've dealt with have been gay, and before you started treating people with AIDS, you knew very few out of the closet homosexuals. Did you have to overcome stereotypes of your own when you were first treating people with HIV?
Absolutely, and I think that the more I talk to my fellow physicians who are in the same position as I am, I think we all, males that is, we all made this peculiar voyage sort of across the gulf of our own homophobia to the point where I now feel like I miss something of value in my early years by denying myself the friendship of people who might have been gay or who were gay because I had the stereotyped image of them. And I think that it's a shame that it took a disease like AIDS to make a male like me make this voyage and come to this understanding. But I've actually come to the understanding that gay men have so much to teach heterosexual men about what it is to be a man. And again, it's tragic that a disease like this should bring that into relief.
You grew up in Ethiopia. Your parents are from India. Did you feel that being a foreigner and therefore an outsider in the United States helped you understand the outsider status that so many homosexuals have in American culture?
I think it did. I think I was very conscious of the fact that I was always looking for a place to call home. And the title, My Own Country, from my book, emanates from the sense of, this nebulous sense of finding a place to live. And I thought this was a curious parallel, that there I was, an alien, my green card was otherwise called the resident alien card, struggling to sort of fit in and, blend in and learn all the rituals of Monday night football and so on. And meanwhile, these gay men, this was their hometown, but this was a hometown that they felt alien in. And instead of trying to blend in, they had actually learned to sort of hide their true nature and fake this sort of blending in until that moment when they could make their escape. And so when they did come back, I often felt that part of the reason that they really opened up to me was the feeling that I would not pass judgment on them the same way their town fathers might, and perhaps even the feeling that I had no right as a foreign physician to pass judgment on them. I'm particularly remembering a preacher who would come to me repeatedly with sexually transmitted diseases and fairly glibly recount his experiences, and I always thought that he would only do this with me because he had a sense that not only would I not pass judgment, perhaps I had no right to pass judgment on his sexual behavior.
My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. His memoir, My Own Country, is about treating people with AIDS in Johnson City, Tennessee. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. I'd like you to describe for us the day you were awakened by a phone call from a dentist that you knew who had extracted a tooth from one of your patients.
It was a bizarre incident. I had been woken up early in the morning by this phone call from a dentist, and I'm not sure how he got my number, and he was absolutely distraught. He had discovered that the tooth he pulled the previous day, and it was a bloody extraction. He had to chip and wedge this tooth out, and there was blood everywhere, as he said. He discovered that this tooth he'd pulled out had come from a patient of mine who had HIV infection, and he was in tears. He was looking for me to sort of reassure him, and he was determined. He said he was going to give up his dental practice, and I took some time to reassure him, but I kept wondering, well, how did he find out that my patient had HIV, because I certainly didn't remember any such conversation, and I didn't set up the dental appointment because it was notoriously difficult to get dental care for my patients. It turned out that my patient had gone to a local pharmacy to get his penicillin filled in after this procedure, and the pharmacist, who also did a lot of my AZT prescriptions, had took it on himself to call up the dentist and say, by the way, do you know that you just pulled a tooth on so-and-so who happens to have HIV. And I was sort of trying to deal with his fear at the same time I was sort of outraged. And I sort of forced him to tell me who had let the cat out of the bag, so to speak. And then I confronted the patient and said, you know, you really had an obligation to let the dentist know ahead of time so he could take appropriate precautions. And the patient came right back at me with what I thought was a fairly reasoned argument. He said, Doc, I tried everyone. My own dentist bumped me from my list. And I said, why? Why did he do that? He said, well, I don't know. You tell me. Maybe he figured out that the only way to protect himself from HIV was to get all the Nellies out of his practice, is the words he used. And so he said, I just was frustrated. This tooth was bothering me. I couldn't get anyone to take it out when I told them I was HIV positive. So I just went through the phone book and picked someone, and I said to myself, this is 1987. This dentist should be protecting himself. It's not my responsibility. So my loyalties were very divided. I was very angry with the pharmacist for, you know, being unprofessional. I was angry with the patient for, you know, subjecting the dentist to this. And I was angry with the dentist for being somewhat cavalier, even though a week or two before I had addressed the Dental Society and told them that universal precautions weren't simply a matter of, banding out these little aphorisms about wear this and do that. This was something real that they had to watch out for.
So you think that the dentist really should have been using rubber gloves and other precautions?
Evidently he was using gloves. His concern came from not from the fact that he wasn't wearing a mask and his eyes weren't protected, and there was blood on his forearms, on his cheek, and he thought that he had splattered himself quite a bit. And I must tell you that in this day and age, that's not an uncommon event, and we know that those sorts of things aren't particularly infectious. You know, thousands and thousands of those kinds of exposures, splashes and so on, haven't really resulted in anyone and too many people converting. So on the scale of things, I wasn't that worried, but he needed to treat every patient as though they were potentially HIV infected. But in that small town, it was something that he just didn't believe he had to do, and he thought he could probably sniff them out, spot them a mile away.
So what happened? He had said maybe he'd give up dentistry. He was so upset. What happened with him?
I'm not sure that I'm privy to what finally happened, because I think that part of what I did with him was to sort of lecture him. And I know that he subsequently got his HIV tests and that they were negative. Whether it altered his practice or not, I'm not certain.
Why did you leave practicing medicine in Johnson City?
Well, I have this sort of self-fulfilling hypothesis, I suppose, that all of us in AIDS care have this need from time to time to sort of find a new geography, almost as though a new set of faces will temporarily sort of clean the slate and allow us to sort of begin again. You know, a strange thing happens when you accrue 80-odd patients, and particularly when you're providing all their care. They somehow become connected to you, almost like children, and with each loss, there's a sense of having lost a part of yourself, and then the sense of all these others who are also, you know, going to get sicker. There's a part of me that felt I just wanted to start again somewhere else. I know very clearly that I wouldn't be in any other line of work, but I think from time to time you need a change of scenery, and I've done that twice now, and I know several other people who've made similar sort of transitions, never away from AIDS, but just a different locale, a new setting, a certain kind of anonymity that they'd lost completely in this little town.
So what are you doing now?
I'm now at Texas Tech University at El Paso. I'm chief of infectious diseases there. I teach at the medical school, have a huge stable of HIV clinic persons. The difference perhaps now is that I have more resources. I have associates with me. And perhaps more than ever, I think there's a sense that the most important ingredient in HIV care is strong community support, support groups, hospices, social services. And we have all that in place in a magnificent way in El Paso. And when I look back in Tennessee, I was trying to do all those different tasks by myself, and it was next to impossible.
In your memoir, My Own Country, about being an AIDS doctor in Johnson City, Tennessee, you write, "No matter how long I practice medicine, no matter what happens with this retrovirus, I will not be able to forget these young men, the little towns they came from, and the cruel, cruel irony of what awaited them in the big city." Let me ask you to elaborate.
Well, I compliment you for finding that paragraph, because that was really the heart of the book. And when I came to that, I cried. And because that was really the root of the book. That was the thing that drove me. And what this emanated from was this one scene that I'd like to describe to you, where I went to the house of a patient who had been ill for many months with raging fever, and I could not find the cause. And I'll call him Hobart, as he's named in the book. He said to me, "After I die, if you want, you can come and take biopsies of my organs. I don't want an autopsy, but at least you'll know what went on." And so I went to his house. I traveled out there and walked through the living room where his parents were grieving alone, no relatives there to comfort them, because that was the nature of it. And I made my way into his bedroom and saw him lying there, you know, wasted and shriveled, almost Christ-like, lying there on a white sheet, his arms folded across his chest. And I was impressed by what was on the wall of this bedroom, which was his childhood bedroom. And it was all these icons from his childhood. It was needlepoint verses that his mother had put up and various other things. And I knew that this was a foreign environment to him, because I had seen photographs of his New York City apartment. I'd seen the icons that he had used to surround himself with. I knew what his memorabilia were. And it just seemed to me horribly tragic that he'd escaped this loving but confining world and gone to the big city. And at the very moment that Hobart discovered who Hobart was meant to be, that this virus should have entered his system, undermined his immune system, and cruelly brought him back to this loving home, but a home that was really not his own country. It was not where he wanted to be.
Did you see that a lot?
A lot. I mean, I think that was the prevailing paradigm. And I must say that families were loving, and even though they took the news of not only that their son had AIDS, but that he was gay and survived it and continued to sort of take care of them, they did so with certain restrictions. It was often difficult for other males to call and inquire and see how the son was doing. You know, it was love, but with certain restrictions and certain definitions. But I think I must say that, you know, people in Tennessee have an unfair reputation, perhaps, for being rednecks and being prejudiced. And I encountered very little of that. And I think that the flip side of being a redneck is sort of unconditional love, where you quickly get past the fact that, you know, your son has lived a way you don't approve, but this is your son, this is your kin, and you take care of your kin. That story, that you know, courage that families express despite being exposed to something so absolutely foreign to them in terms of gay men and AIDS, the courage they expressed is really admirable too.
Were you expected to be something of a cultural intermediary in situations like that between your patient who was dying and his parents?
I often wound up being one. I found myself more than once explaining homosexuality because I would be asked this question, well, doc, how do they get that way? And, you know, it was a question that obviously I had wrestled with too, and I'd come to my own sort of understanding of it, and I would sort of, you know, I would say, look, you know, the God-given talent that you're so proud about with your son, I think his gayness is also, you know, a God-given gayness, if you will. I really do subscribe to the business of this being nature and not nurture. And yes, I functioned as sort of a intermediary, someone whom they knew was heterosexual and yet was sympathetic. And so perhaps they looked to me to sort of help explain this world that they were discovering in their sick son.
Dr. Abraham Verghese has written a new memoir called My Own Country. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More with Dr. Verghese in the second part of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Abraham Verghese. He's written a memoir about how the AIDS epidemic looked from the vantage point of a doctor in a small town during the second part of the 1980s. His memoir about his work in Johnson City, Tennessee, is called My Own Country. The memoir is also about his experiences as a foreign doctor in America. Dr. Verghese grew up in Ethiopia. His parents were from the south of India. Dr. Verghese told me what brought them to Ethiopia.
My community is a Christian community in the south of India, and our Christianity supposedly originates from St. Thomas the Apostle having landed on the coast of India and converted some Brahmins there. So even my name, Verghese, really is akin to the Verghese of the Italians and the Verghese of Greeks and so on. In fact, I'm often addressed as Verghese, and it seems to come very naturally to my Italian friends. But the emperor, Haile Selassie, when he got Mussolini out of his country, came on a state visit to India to see the churches of St. Thomas in the south of India. And I think he was very taken with the sight that at 7:45 in the morning there were these hordes of schoolchildren heading to school, because that state, Kerala, is still one of the most literate states in India. And he was so moved by that he decided that he was going to hire all his teachers for the schools he was setting up across his country from this one state. So in a very peculiar fashion, my father and mother and 400 to 500 other teachers were hired, and my father and mother met there, and my brother and I were born in Ethiopia and grew up there.
So, after growing up in Ethiopia, why did you decide to study medicine in the United States?
Well, actually, I began to study medicine in Ethiopia when the war broke out and the emperor was deposed. And I think until then, I had a sense that that was my place in the world, even though
Ethiopia, we
were still Indian citizens, but I was fluent in the language, my friends were all Ethiopian. And that was sort of a moment of definition for me, because it suddenly became apparent that when they used the phrase expatriates and outsiders, they were referring to me unbelievably. And so I had no more place in that country. We were literally asked to leave. And I came to America, where my parents had already come. And for a year or so, I worked as an orderly in nursing homes and hospitals, trying to get back on track. But my status as sort of a displaced person made it very difficult to sort of make the transition from their schools in Ethiopia to America. So I went back to India, because the Indian government accepted my situation and took me in. And then when I finished there, I came to America to join my parents again and seek further training here. In a sense, the book, you know, the title, My Own Countries, is all about that sense of searching for a place where I can be, a country I can identify with, a place that I can set roots in. And in a way, the search still goes on. I'm an American and very proud to be one. The search for an identity, a place that you can spin your little personal myth, I think continues. Although I must say that in arriving in El Paso, I felt I'd finally arrived in a place where I could perhaps disappear. I mean, El Paso, as you know, has a huge Hispanic population, and my coffee-colored skin sort of blends in there, and I have the sense of having finally disappeared in America, if you will.
When you were trying to get established in American medicine, did you find that there were certain hospitals that were more open to accepting interns or residents from foreign countries?
Well, yeah, yes, indeed. In fact, it's very clear that there's a two-tiered system of medicine at the graduate level when you come to this country. Foreign physicians are absolutely critical to the running of inner-city hospitals like, say, Cook County, to name a few, who wouldn't survive without this influx of manpower year after year.
Why wouldn't they survive?
Well, I think because it's difficult to attract young American graduates, particularly in fields like internal medicine that are not necessarily lucrative. It's difficult to attract internal medicine interns and residents to places like, you know, inner-city urban hospitals when they could go to more prestigious academic centers or more fancy hospitals in smaller towns. And so year after year, we recruit. I mean, even in my place, we are doing this, recruit physicians from foreign countries to fill our acute manpower needs because many city hospitals rely on these patients, on these physicians to provide patient care.
What were you culturally unprepared for when you started working in American inner city hospitals after growing up in Ethiopia?
Well, I think, you know, what would be interpreted by some as being, you know, horrendous working conditions, when you compare them to the conditions in places I had worked in Africa and Ethiopia and India were really fine. I mean, I had really very little cause for complaint. I actually bypassed the inner city hospital and wound up going to Tennessee to do my residency and then came back to Boston City Hospital to do my fellowship and then went back again. So I saw the whole spectrum, you know, of medical care in this country. And I think the thing we have to remember is that it's so vastly superior to what is available elsewhere that some of these differences are relative. Nonetheless, foreign graduates coming in really have very little choice. They're shunted to these programs. And then, you know, later on, it's difficult for them to break through, even at the fellowship or specialty training level, into the more desirable specialties because, again, they've come from a residency or a training program that is considered to be in this second level.
My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. His memoir, My Own Country, is about being a foreign doctor in America and treating people with AIDS in Johnson City, Tennessee. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. His new memoir, My Own Country, is about being an AIDS doctor. You know, I think some American patients are probably uncomfortable with foreign doctors because they fear, the patients fear that they won't be understood. Either their language won't be understood if the doctor doesn't speak English as a first language, or they fear they won't be understood on some kind of like larger metaphorical level when they're describing their symptoms or trying to describe in shorthand who they are and what their larger problems are. Did you run across this a lot?
Yes, I did. I think it's really a remarkable sort of situation. I think it's a testament to this country and our openness that we, you know, we can have situations like that. But I always thought it was a strange paradox to be in a small mining town in Tennessee where people were really intensely sort of inbred and, you know, full of regional myths and heavy accents. And for them to be taken care of from someone from a totally different culture with his or her own mythology, her own accent, and so on. It was really curious to see these two worlds come together. The interesting thing is that with time, once one gets over that initial sort of discomfort, foreign physicians, by and large, have an excellent reputation for being sound physicians, for being caring. Perhaps they don't have a very good reputation for blending in with the community. I think many have retained those elements that made them different. And many in the community have seen that as being somewhat standoffish or somewhat opportunistic even. But I continue to be struck, even today, when I go to a VA hospital to visit or to give grand rounds, to see, you know, veterans in some of the oldest veteran hospitals in the country being taken care of by the newest immigrants. It's at once a tribute to this country and at the same time sort of very curious.
Did you find that your American patients had a different standard of comfort or health than the patients who you'd seen in Ethiopia? You know, what they considered to be normal and acceptable?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, so much of medicine in Ethiopia and countries like India isn't driven by physicians. It isn't driven by what a physician has to offer. It's driven by what money there is available. And, you know, I worked in a clinic in India briefly where all I had to offer my patient was scabies ointment and vitamin A pills and some oral penicillin, although it was limited. So it didn't matter what they came in with. I had to, in terms of therapy, this is all I had to offer. And I think many people see foreign physicians as coming to this country chasing, you know, a financial dream. And perhaps that's true, but I think they're also chasing the opportunity to sort of fulfill themselves as physicians. Because if you're going to work for the government, the ingredient that the government lacks that you will need to provide good medical care is money. And so you either wind up working for the private sector in fancy hospitals that cater to, often to people from the Middle East who don't quite have enough money to get to London or Sloan Kettering, and they come to Bombay and Madras for their transplants or whatever. You find yourself in that curious situation of providing medical care to those who have a lot of money. And I think this is at the root of much of the frustration that results in foreign physicians looking to come to America.
You've been treating people with AIDS for how long now?
Well, I've been involved with AIDS since 83, almost the year before the HIV test became available. All my professional life as an infectious disease specialist. And I must tell you that I entered infectious disease because I thought this is the one specialty where we can cure people. You have to understand, there was a very exciting era, antibiotics, and we were making such gains with leukemics and transplant patients. And the moment I started training, AIDS arrived. And when I say this to medical students, that I entered entered infectious disease because of the possibility of cure, they really break out laughing. They think it's hilarious.
Do you get yourself tested now?
I don't routinely. I only do when I get splashed or exposed. And when I do, a curious thing happens. My life seems to come to a standstill until I get the result, and therefore I don't really get tested unless I'm convinced that, you know, that it's intellectually a smart thing to do because of a certain event. I really don't feel at risk in almost anything I do with my patients. I'm quite comfortable with that. I must tell you, the thing I worry about more than anything else, and I think this is true of all my colleagues, is multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. If people drop out from AIDS care, it will not be AIDS. It will be the threat of something like that that is truly untreatable and it's truly a menace.
How often are you splashed in such a way that you feel is necessary to get tested?
Well, I do bronchoscopies. Perhaps I'm exceptional in that I'm an infectious disease physician who does a pulmonary procedure. I'm actually board certified in pulmonary medicine. And I think over the years, many of us have wound up doing lots of things that pertain to other specialties just because we didn't want to subject someone else to the sort of hassle of saying, would you mind doing this? And they say, sure, but inside they're saying, gosh, I wish you wouldn't ask me. So we do bone marrow biopsies, we do bronchoscopies, we do skin biopsies. And in the course of all that, I'd say once a year or so, it's not uncommon to have some sort of exposure and then have the need to go get tested.
How did you start writing?
I had been writing all along little essays that sort of stemmed from you know, what I would see at work, and I'd been publishing them fairly successfully, and then began to write short stories. And I kept feeling that I was writing out of this urgent need to somehow transform what I was seeing at work because it was so disturbing. And initially it was in the form of journal entries. And then since I could not control death, since I could not turn back time, since I was always limited as a scientist by the boundaries of the real world, I absolutely enjoy delving into fiction where I can do all these things. I can turn back time, I can successfully reverse things, I can enter other people's heads. It's in a way, it's a necessary escape for me.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Abraham Verghese, his new memoir is called My Own Country. Dr. Verghese is now professor of medicine and chief of infectious diseases at Texas Tech Health Sciences Center in El Paso, Texas. This is Fresh Air.